Welcome, everyone, to Film Strips, the podcast that would actually be much better if we had a small child with us at all the time. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanigeiser. And wait, what's this in the back seat? I was wondering what that smell was. Dave, we seem to have picked up a hitchhiker.
Well, it's not a child's hitchhiker who can actually sing, right?
Unless it's a child who's like 6'4" and has a beard and kind of looks like Don Henley.
Okay, no. Well, that's...
You were correct in your assumptions. I'm the boy from Blues Brothers 2000.
Wait, you're J. Evan Bonafont?
Yes.
What happened?
I played Buster in the hit film, the Super Smash Blues Brothers 2000.
Wow.
I need your help. Dan Aykroyd has me still. The movie never really ended. I'm still in his basement.
How can we assist you, J. Evan?
I need you to get the original Bluesmobile, and I need you to get the flux capacitor, go back in time, and bring John Belushi back. He's key. He's on the planet Octu, and you need to convince him to come back.
But Jay Evan, what happened to planet Oc-1?
I have to go. He's coming. Dan Aykroyd's coming. He's going to get mad and throw Ghostbusters at me. Bye. Sorry, guys.
Well,
sorry about that. I found an opening for improv, and I did it. Thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it. This is Christopher Martin here. I'm an old friend of these guys.
Yes, and you may remember him from his frequent guest appearances on 24 Panels Per Second, the podcast about comic books on film. Also, the show that actually had a really clever tagline that simply explained what the program was.
So good.
You may also know him from his marriage to Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yes, we went for the cheap joke early.
Of course. I wonder why we were inspired to do that, David. It's almost like we watch a movie that's its entire operating premise.
Well, yes, but of course that requires a little bit of explanation, because you see, this is the podcast which every episode takes a look at one film, puts it under a microscope, dissects it, and then discusses it for an exceedingly long length of time. But the catch is, it somehow has to connect back to the film we discussed the previous episode. And Andrew, what was the episode we were looking at previously on this little program of ours?
Well, last week we were looking at David Byrne's quasi-vanity project, quasi-slice of small-town Americana true stories, which featured a wonderful acting and musical performance by John Goodman, who we're following to this week. 1998's sequel that never had a reason and never had a chance, Blues Brothers 2000. Directed by everybody's favorite free man, John Landis.
oh boy. This we're getting right off on the good tangents now here, folks. Having learned nothing from the ladies' man, we decided to take a look at another terrible SNL-inspired movie. Although, we can't blame Lorne Michaels for this one, so it's got that going for it, I guess.
Well, we need someone to blame for this train wreck, but I guess we're tipping our hand a little bit early. So, I mean, we were saying right before we started recording, though, Blues Brothers, I don't think we can look at a film like Blues Brothers 2000 with our typical approach, simply because there is so much that is stunningly just unexplainable about this film and why it is. But David, that being said, you also got the pick for this week, and you selected...
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
This was y'all on you here, sir.
This was me? Oh, this man. Was you. Proof that the brain does weird things after trauma. Okay. Well... Yeah. I honestly can't recall what I was thinking other than this will be an interesting discussion. So maybe there's still hope for that. But Dave, let me ask you, you've probably seen The Blues Brothers much more recently than I have, because I didn't see it probably since I was about 10. So maybe you're better equipped to explain, who are the Blues Brothers? Where do they come from? And what do they want to do with their lives?
Well, folks, I need to take you back to a little decade called the 1970s here for a second, where a little program we discussed not so long ago called Saturday Night Live was in its infancy. And during this time, two of its main stars were Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi. One of them a Canadian, one of them from, I think, Chicago? I'm not entirely positive.
They're the original Odd Couple.
Yes. The key thing being that Dan Aykroyd was a huge blues fan, and ended up introducing John Belushi, noted metalhead, into the to the blues, where they sort of bonded over this and decided, hey, wouldn't it be fun if we sort of had our own little blues band on the side? Which they did. And then they brought it on the show. It was kind of a hit. Lo and behold, things went from there, and as Aykroyd and Belushi's star increased, thanks to both the work they were doing on Saturday Night Live itself, and appearances in other films such as Belushi in Animal House, and Aykroyd in 1941, along with Belushi, although that was a bomb, so maybe that isn't the best example I could have come up with right off the bat here.
I don't know what that movie is, so...
Steven Spielberg's 1941?
Yeah, no. I haven't seen every movie, flop. David.
Okay, man, we need to get this on the show, because if you want to see Spielberg make a real bad movie early on in his career, this is the one to go with.
Oh, and he spoofs Jaws. Remember that?
Sorry?
He parodies his own movie with Jaws.
Oh, yeah.
At the beginning of the film. He just goes for it. It's really fun.
Yeah, it's a doozy of a movie. But not the one we're here to discuss. But yes, the key
can
thing
it be? I can pretend.
Yeah. But the thing here is Animal House is kind of key here, because Animal House is where a little individual named John Landis met John Belushi. And they sort of got along, which got Landis involved with these crew. And him and Dan Aykroyd ended up spitballing ideas and coming up with the idea of turning the Blues Brothers into a feature film, a musical road comedy slash action pick that would allow them to not only, you know, engage in a fairly wild musical adventure, but in bring in all these classic blues artists who at the time were supposedly being sort of pushed to the margins by the growing force known as disco and electronic music. So, notably, this film comes out in 1980, and I think, Chris, you can join me in on this. It's a stone cold classic, is it not?
Oh, it's so good. Here's what happened. So I was watching this movie a few days ago, and I was watching Blues Brothers 2000. And so I started it, and I was watching it with my partner, and she kept asking about references in this this film, Blues Brothers 2000, the references that they make to the original film. And then I started watching the original film, just intending to watch a clip of, you know, Ray Charles, that performance, Shake Your Tail Feather. And then I ended up watching the movie instead of watching Blues Brothers 2000. It's just such a great rock and roll. When I say rock and roll, I mean just like a great music film. This is great, great performances. You're seeing some edgy, just there's a dangerous edge to the Blues Brothers. And this is going to come up again, because whatever edge Blues Brothers had is gone by the time Blues Brothers 2000 happens.
Yeah. It feels very defanged. And like, yes. I was talking to David and saying like, but this film doesn't only go wrong or feel so tonally different just because Belushi isn't in this one. It is a fundamentally different film than, at least certainly, what I remember the original Blues Brothers being.
Well, this is the thing. So, to make what could be a very long story short, the original Blues Brothers is the tale of Jake and Elwood Blues, played by Belushi and Aykroyd, respectively. A couple of, you know, musicians slash convicts who, current with Elwood or Jake now out of prison, decide they need to put their band back together. But not just put the band back together for the sake of it. See, they're in a mission to save their old orphanage that is currently at threat of foreclosure if they can't pay the taxes.
The noblest of causes.
Yes, and after an encounter with a reverend played by the one, the only James Brown, Jake has an epiphany where he realizes they have been given a God-given mission to save this orphanage by putting the band back together, or, as Elwood likes to put it, we're on a mission from God. And the entire film basically involves them trying to do something that seems fairly simple. Get your band back together, play some shows, make some money, pay off the orphanage's taxes. This ultimately involves them having to face up against neo-Nazis, most of the Illinois State Police Department, and a bucket load of other individuals who just want their heads on a platter. And the film, of course, builds to a series of iconic music performances and stunt sequences, including an absolutely killer chase inside a mall.
I'm going to stop you there, David, though, because aside from the words iconic, a car chase inside of a mall, and great musical performances, like, this does sound like the exact same film, only there isn't a sense of purpose or direction motivating it.
Well, okay, here's the thing. So, Blues Brothers comes out in 1980. It is a huge smash, cementing Aykroyd and Belushi as megastars. And this would go on for many, many 3 years before Belushi died of a drug overdose. From that point forward, Aykroyd would have to carry on with his career on his own, and would, of course, achieve a great deal of success with films such as Spies Like Us, also with John Landis, and a little thing called Ghostbusters, which one day we'll probably discuss when it doesn't feel like we can do so without everybody ready to murder everyone else. But
hey, back off. It's an integral part of my childhood.
Well, yeah. See, here's the thing. So, Blues Brothers, you know, with Belushi dead, you would kind of assume that, you know, Blues Brothers would just sort of go away. And you would be right. For 18 years.
Yeah. You know who else died in the meantime? Vic Morrow.
All right, so
hey, but before we go on, like the Vic Morrow point there, did you notice during this film, during one of the stunts, Aykroyd grabs Buster and he's a dummy when they're running away from one of the car explosions? Did anybody notice that? Do you think that was being extra careful because of the Vic Morrow situation, or an insurance thing?
I'll put it to you this way. I can guarantee from the sounds of it in the years. Oh, man. Should we get up on a tangent right off the bat on this thing?
It's more interesting than talking about Blues Brothers 2000. Because Understanding the context of just all the weirdness of this film is... It's all a prerequisite to understanding why it is the way it is.
Okay, a couple things. We have made jokes about John Landis on the show before, and I want to be very clear about this. John Landis, I think, once upon a time, was a great filmmaker. I think he has at least three Stone Cold classics to his name, including The Blues Brothers, including Coming to America, and honestly, I really, really love Into the Night. However, having said that, John Landis is a man who also managed to direct a portion of a film called The Twilight Zone Movie, and if you have paid attention to the little image we use for our podcast online, it is a image of Dan Aykroyd and Albert Brooks from the John Landis-directed opening of that film, which is hands down one of the best jump scare sequences you will ever see,
yep,
folks.
I still have to watch it with covered eyes. But Twilight Zone comes out in 1983, so after the first Blues Brothers movie, and before this one.
Yeah, so, here's the thing. During that time, John Landis went to shoot his full segment for the Twilight Zone movie, an original, the only original in that film, in fact, starring one Vic Morrow, about a bigot who ends up basically being forced to experience a series of racial discrimination and trauma
He finally gets to see what it's like to be persecuted through the ages. Next scene is a bunch of old people turning into kids and playing with Scatman Crothers.
Thanks, Spielberg. But the thing about it is during the shooting of this film, what ends up happening is was supposed to be a sequence where Vic Morrow basically having a turn of heart while I believe it was supposed to be a sequence set during Vietnam.
Yeah.
Decides to rescue a couple of Vietnamese children from a helicopter that's looking like it's going to crash behind them. There's an entire... What ends up happening is up for debate entirely about who knew what and when and why.
Well, the final result is that the stunt goes terribly wrong, and then Morrow and the two child actors were killed in the accident. And then afterwards, it turns out there weren't exactly proper legalities followed in terms of youth employment, in terms of, you know, just like what they were licensed to do on set at that time. Labor laws matter, people, because this is what happens when they're not followed.
Yeah, basically, as a result from this, Steven Spielberg mysteriously disappears from America for well over a year, shooting a film called Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, for which he claimed he couldn't come back to America because it was just taking a lot of time for him to focus on this movie, and not because he was potentially somebody who could also be involved in any sort of legalities involving this, because he was a producer on that film. Landis, on the other hand, did end up going to trial along with several other individuals. Landis was ultimately found not criminally liable for the situation. If I remember the trial information correctly, ultimately it was the individual in charge of stunts who would end up going to end up serving some prison time for this. I do believe, however, and I may be wrong on this, Landis did end up paying out a substantial fee. The point of being during this is that for many people, this might be the kind of thing that destroys your career. For John Landis, that didn't actually kind of happen.
It became a curse, and he had to make Blues Brothers 2000 as penance.
Well, you would think, but... Oh, God.
Maybe. This is such a weird conversation for such a weird movie. But go on.
18 minutes. We're almost at 18 minutes of a backstory. But in part two, we're going to actually start talking about Blues Brothers 2000.
Okay, yeah, maybe this could be like the prologue episode. What? The John Landis thing explained by David.
Okay. Point of the matter is after this, Landis probably did escape criminal justice. I think looking at the case overall, that seems to be, I personally stand by the notion that Landis got off really easy.
Well, the fact of the matter is, regardless of what one wants to think about the law, he was directing a movie where three people ended up dead. So, fact of the matter, that regardless, you can't get around that.
Well, no, absolutely not. And the thing about it beyond that is, supposedly, Landis is somebody who has taken the incident to heart. You don't see him talk about it, understandably, I can imagine that's not the sort of thing he really wants to be touting around and talking about at a moment's
notice.
But is that
the kind of thing that, you know, the media really asks about? Does TMZ have a thing where it's like, we got John Landis at LAX? And then Harvey's like, I love John.
See, here's the thing. For those of you who listen to the podcast 80s All Over, hosted by Drew McWeeny, no, not Drew Jeffries, and Scott Weinberg, they actually end up talking about an incident during the making of the television show Masters of Horror, where a crew member apparently was reading a book about the Twilight Zone, the making of the Twilight Zone, and that incident right in front of John Landis. As a kind of thing. And Landis apparently was very much like, he actually asked Landis, can you sign my copy of the book? To which Landis is like, look, I don't appreciate you bringing this up. I would rather not have anything to do about this. Like,
I'm glad he doesn't appreciate being asked about it.
Well, but this is one of those things where it's like, yeah, this is, like, I don't know what to make of Landis, because he always seems like a very, you know, like, he's not somebody who dwells on things. I don't know. But that, again, that could be a put-upon persona. The truth of the matter is, just regardless of this, is that after this incident, yeah, I think from the sounds of things, Landis was always much, much more careful about how he ran his sets. But
this seems like the only post-Twilight Zone movies by John Landis that really stick out for me is The Stupids, which is absolutely a kid-friendly film. And it is so much fun. It is not stylistically dissimilar from certain aspects of Blues Brothers 2000, but it's fun and it's goofy, and like there's just something very earnest in its stupidity. And it's enjoyable in a lot of ways that this film falls completely flat, and it seems like it's trying to do the same thing.
Well, okay, here's the thing. So basically, in the intervening 18 years, despite the Blue Twilight Zone, the movie, Landis actually goes on to have a series of pretty significant hits throughout the rest of the 1980s. In the same year Twilight Zone, the movie comes out, he also has Trading Places with Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy come out, which was one of the top grossing movies of that year. He, from that point forward, he also had Into the Night, Coming to America, and then the 90s happen. And this is where, for Landis, we get to things like Innocent Blood, an interesting but not great film.
That's an unfortunate title.
Oscar, the Sylvester Stallone mob comedy.
That one. Yeah, I always mix it up with Bugsy. And then I remember, oh wait, no, they both existed.
Yeah, and from that point, eventually, yes, arriving at The Stupids, which I'm going to have to disagree with you on this one, Andrew, because I really don't like that film.
You know what, guys, I'm getting the red light from the producer. This has been Film Strips today, your number one choice for John Landis movie trivia. We will be back next week with some more John Landis facts.
Sorry. All right. Sorry. Well, all right. But, you know, that's a good point. We should really wrap this up and actually get to just talking about Blues Brothers 2000.
Yes. So we'll be back in about 5 seconds in your podcast feed with part two of Blues Brothers 2000, in which our heroes actually get around to talking about Blues Brothers 2000.
I have a real question here, because I looked this up, Dave, and I know you couldn't find a lot of facts in relation to this film. But why did Dan Aykroyd want to make this movie? What was going on here? Because I can't find a definitive answer as to, I understand he wants to recapture the former glory of the Blues Brothers.
Well,
but
this is
what was the catalyst where he thought 1998 is the time, we gotta get a Blues Brothers film in the theaters before 2000. And it's gotta happen now.
Well, that's what I don't understand. Like, I don't understand what the catalyst for this movie was. Apparently, Aykroyd and Landis did pitch versions of this to the studio at some point during the 90s.
Okay.
And eventually got this going. But over the course of developing whatever the sequel was going to be, the key thing about it is that Landis, by his own admission, admits that one of the things that happened was, yes, the studio was the one that wanted to make it more kid-friendly.
Right, that's what I understand too, yeah.
Yeah, they wanted to make sure that there was a kid in the film and that it would be more fantasy-oriented in general. And the thing about it is apparently they were close to quitting the movie, but were convinced by Robert K. Weiss, who was the producer on the original film, and as near as I can tell, was a studio executive at Universal at this point, to stick around in the movie. Hence why he gets name-dropped in this film when Aykroyd's gives a speech about, do it for Robert K. Weiss, while listing off all these other acts, and everybody's like, who is Robert K. Weiss?
But I really think that's part of why, like, that joke right there is sort of endemic to what's wrong with this film, and why I do not understand why studio execs would think, like, making it a youth-oriented film would work, because, like, when that joke is delivered, the guys turn to each other and go, who's Robert K. Weiss? Do 10-year-old kids who are going to enjoy skeleton cowboys descending from the clouds, are they going to know who Robert K. Weiss is? Do 12-year-olds in 1998 have a deep appreciation of Muddy Waters and Buddy Guy? You know, like, have any interest in seeing Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper, like, try and hurry out of a diner?
Who watched the original film and, you know, this is a cocaine-fueled chaos of a film and thought, you know, there just aren't enough children in it. I don't know. You know what? I really felt like when I watched this movie, I'm a big Beatles fan, and I felt like this movie was the Beatles anthology of motion pictures, where you have a dead member of the group, and where the Beatles anthology actually reused a recording of John Lennon for a new Beatles track. We don't have a new recording or anything from John Belushi, and this is the Paul McCartney of Blues Brothers films, where it's Dan Aykroyd again misunderstanding why people like the original film. You know, Dan Aykroyd doing his Dan Aykroyd Aykroydiness of writing, where, you know, you write a movie called Ghostbusters. What do you think it's about? It's about guys who bust ghosts but jump through time and space and fade through color. It's like, no, that's not it. That's
What's
not it,
Blues
Dan.
Brothers 2000 about? Yeah. It's about Blues Brothers, and there's 2,000 of them. They start a revolution.
Yeah, right. And there's never a point where the 2,000 comes into play, but I wrote down a few things that it's about, because I have a few synopsises, and I wrote them while I watched the movie. I'm just going to read one.
Okay.
Blues Brothers 2000 is a science fiction fantasy about a strip club that showcases two middle-aged male singers.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, and
it's also a kid-oriented film.
I also have another one. Blues Brothers 2000 is a hard-boiled look at corruption in the Catholic Church when a child gets kidnapped and it goes unreported for days.
Okay, well, here's the thing. All right.
You're not wrong at all, though.
He's not wrong. Here's the thing, because here's the thing about Blues Brothers 2000. It is as we've already made very clear in this very rambly 25 minutes worth of podcast so far, this is a terrible, terrible movie that doesn't seem to have any reason to exist. But, and I am going to put this out there, for the first 7 minutes of this movie, I was actually convinced that there was a reason for this to exist and that there was a legitimate creative effort that would have been, that had it gone this road, would have made this entire endeavor worthwhile. This is not the film we get, but allow me to explain.
This is fun. Okay. So we're going into the part of the podcast right now. This is Blues Brothers Fantasy League. This is where we talk about our ideal Blues Brothers film, and I have one written too. All right, let's go.
Okay. Okay, here's the thing. The original Blues Brothers, as we've noted, you know, was filled with, you know, not just musical acts, but also with a ton of great comedic talent. But in the years after Blues Brothers came out in 1980, the world lost John Belushi, like 3 years afterwards. John Candy, who was in the film as a police officer, died in the 90s. And then after him, Cab Calloway, who had the significant role as the basically the man who more or less raised Jake and Elwood while they were in the orphanage and introduced them to the blues, which changed their lives. He had passed away as well. And the thing is when this movie opens, the first thing you see before anything else is a dedication to those three men.
But they're okay.
Well, let me finish.
David, you're right. I think the scene that follows it is great, but I think that in itself sets this film up to be something very weird, because the very first thing that it does is, by the way, everybody, your favorites aren't going to be here because they're gone, for real. But, you know, we're also dedicating our film to them. So everything you're about to see, we were inspired by their memory. And it also feels like, and also if you hate this film, we dedicated it to them. So you're basically urinating on their graves if you don't like what you're going to see. So thanks okay. for the money.
But let me finish here. The point of the matter is, this is a film that in its opening 7 minutes acknowledges the fact that time has gone on, people have died, including people who were very key to the success of the original and were very much close to Aykroyd and John Landis personally. And in this instance, when the film opens, basically, even though the film is a retread, it basically opens up with the perfect echo of the original movie. Because in the original film, it opens up with Jake getting out of prison. And basically, you see him being walked through the prison yards, eventually being given back all his stuff by the person in charge of basically prisoner property, played by Frank Oz. And as the film opens up, it's Jake getting, you know, finally in his full-blown black and white suit, sunglasses on, walking out of the prison yard to be picked up by Elwood as she comes, or the Katie, kicks in on the soundtrack. And it is a beautiful, amazing opening sequence.
Just for the record, we all really enjoy that opening sequence, right?
Like, yeah, I think so.
It's well done.
It's the most coherent sequence in the entire film.
That's true. If this was made now, it would end there, and it would be a viral video on the internet, and it would say, with love to John, or something. Or it would, like I said to Dave earlier this week, or it would be hawking a product at the Super Bowl, where they would have Ray-Ban sunglasses, you know, like forever.
Yeah, where Aykroyd walks into a bar and orders a Stella, and he's like, you won't believe the day I've had.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly where that fits.
Yeah. So what ends up happening is, because we still haven't actually explained what happens in the opening here, is that, yes, basically we see the echo of that with Elwood getting out of prison. But instead on the soundtrack, we get John the Revelator as a solo performance, very mournfully being played as he's walking through the prison, going through the same motions. Frank Oz is back now as the head of the prison. And yeah, we see Elwood get out, stand by the doors, and much like he was, and just wait for his brother to arrive. And it's only after the night passes that basically Oz recognizes that, oh, nobody's actually told him that his brother has passed away while he's been in prison. And this leads to a very wonderful shot where he comes out, and in a basically a long distance shot, without being able to hear what's going on, Oz just delivers the news to Elwood that, yeah, his brother has passed away. There's, you know, he's not coming to pick him up like he did for Jake years ago. And yeah, at this point, what this film could have been is basically about coping with grief and coping with the loss of somebody that is this significant to you. And the idea of, you know, again, even if it is a kind of a retread, the idea of Elwood putting the band back together because he needs something. He needs some grounding to make sense of what his life is going to be like from now on.
But instead, what we end up getting is a film where he's not... Like, the grief aspect and the coping aspect is dropped almost immediately. Because,
oh, yeah,
like, when he's finally... That first conversation he has with the drummer, like, it's not like, I need something to go on. It's not I miss my brother. It's I miss having a band. We need to get the band back together, because nothing's better when everyone's shouting and the house is rocking.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're not wrong. I mean, that's the problem. It's like, if the film had actually been about that, it would have been about something. And it would have actually been something more meaningful. It would have been a melancholy comedy about, yeah.
Or even if it ends with them realizing that, oh, it turns out that trying to just have a band to rock away your troubles, that's actually escaping our actual grief instead of dealing with it. You know, this film could tack on a coda and be more sensible that way. But yeah, that none of that happens. And that's such a shame, because that first scene, like, the three of us, we all agree it's not a good movie, but that's a good scene that opens the film.
Oh, so good. Yeah. Here's my pitch. Just a quick one, since we're throwing them out there. I had an idea about, you know, just based around that scene, the Blues Brother, singular. We go the Logan route. We see a Blues Brother without his significant brother. And instead of going and replacing, you know, his family, so to speak, we maybe journey. It's a solo journey of Elwood, and we see him just watching these legendary performers in the background, like in the original, where they're just admiring them. And then you have a nice love story, a nice love letter to, you know, the R&B classics, as well as John Belushi. A somber, dry comedy. The Blues Brother.
Yeah, no, and that, again, that would be a potential route to play it. Instead, we get, I don't even know what to describe this as, because
a lot of things happen.
Yeah.
It is full of sound and fury, I'll give it that.
It definitely had sound, and it had color.
Okay, let's put it to you this way. The film at least gestures towards the plot, because much like in the original film, one of the first places Elwood stops is basically to see the sister who raised him. Only now she's running a, what's more or less,
she's
like
the
a
mother now.
Yeah, she's a mother now, and she's running effectively, I guess it's like a children's hospital slash, or not quite an orphanage there.
It's basically an orphanage. Let's just call it an orphanage.
Yeah, so what he ends up happening here is two things end up happening that are sort of significant. The one is interesting, where he ends up discovering that again, the man who raised him, played by Cab Calloway in the original.
Curtis?
Curtis. Ends up, he's passed away, but what he ends up finding out is that Curtis actually had a son, because he had an affair with a married woman. He basically agreed to stay out of their lives, but he would send money along to her to make sure that his son was raised right. And that, yes, he is actually a man by the name of Cable, who is a police officer in the city of Chicago.
Is he played by Josh Brolin?
He is not played by Josh Brolin, although one of the things that is noteworthy about the production history of this film that we can confirm is that the original version of this plot line was supposed to be that Jake actually had a biological brother, rather than Curtis having a biological son, and the role would have been played by James Belushi John Belushi's real life brother. So exactly. This film could have been so much worse if James Belushi had been in this thing. But yes, the point being that, okay, he finds that out, but then the mother, in what is the first of many baffling moments of this film, decides that the best thing for Elwood is to put him in him, a convicted felon who's just gotten out of prison, in charge of a small child by the name of Buster, and that he is to take him to the library and come back. And at this point in time, if you're scratching your head and wondering, where did logic go in this movie? Well,
it's okay. It only means you are sane.
Yeah, yeah, it's a nice callback to a much better movie. Maybe it's because Dan Aykroyd, he's just trying to replicate his success. He's like, Blues Brothers, okay, that worked. Let's make a new one of that. Ghostbusters, we'll have a kid named Buster. Problem solved.
Could be.
Buster makes him feel good. But he's given a lecture about what an irresponsible person he is, and then immediately trusted with this orphan boy named Buster, who I do love, the thickness of his Chicago accent.
Yeah.
It's like, this is a shop-worn 10-year-old, let me tell you.
Yeah. So instead of taking Buster to the library like he's supposed to and then bring him right back, instead they go to see Curtis's son Cable in probably one of the better scenes in this movie. And mainly because if this film has one bright spot, one entire bright spot in this film, it is Joe Morton is playing Cable, or as he will later come to be known as Cab. A tribute to one Cab Calloway. They go to see him, and basically Elwood, in admittedly one of the funnier scenes, basically breaks the news to him that, oh, by the way, the person you thought was your biological father all these years actually wasn't. Your mom had an affair with somebody else, and by the way, can you, join my band, and B, can you loan me $500 so I can buy a former police cruiser as a vehicle that I can drive around in?
Yeah, that scene did make me laugh because of how much Morton commits to it. And when he just repeats it back, where he's like, the last time you played a show, you got arrested, you caused $24 million in property damage, and now you want me to join your band? And the disgust in his voice, yelling about the band. I'm like, okay, that hits a note of absurdity I like. And probably the one thing Aykroyd did that made me laugh in this film is his reaction of, I'll show you all the moves.
Yes. From this point forward, basically, yeah, Aykroyd swipes five through the power of Buster turning out to be a pickpocket as Elwood's getting thrown out of the police station. Yes, they get the money to go buy this car and then proceed to go to the one place where Elwood knows he can secure a job. Basically a strip club with one of his former bandmates, who is willing to put him on as a singing act. And from here, he meets Mighty Mac, played by John Goodman. Now, okay, here's one of the things. Apparently, Dan Aykroyd and John Goodman pretty much made this movie for nothing. They apparently sacrificed their pay in order to help get this thing made and keep the budget manageable.
Okay, Ross Perot funded his own campaign. That doesn't make it a good idea.
No, and I agree. The thing is, I can understand why Dan Aykroyd might do this. However misbegotten this movie is, I can at least believe that at some point in time, this was a passion project for Dan Aykroyd. What was John Goodman's excuse?
Well, he was living high off that Roseanne money.
Yeah, I guess that could be the case. But
that's where he also discovered his love for the harmonica.
Oh, God, yeah. So, effectively, from this point, most of the major pieces are in play, and the film that ends up happening is basically Elwood, through a combination of misunderstandings and just outright refusal to accept reality for what it is, manages to tick off the Russian mafia to the point where they destroy the bar. Him and Mac end up having to go on the run with Buster, who inexplicably Elwood has not dumped off back with the mother. And from this point forward, they start reuniting the band because, I don't know. I I'm still not sure what his actual goal is.
Well, he has to get the band back together so then his agent can book them at Erykah Badu's Voodoo Battle of the Bands, which they lose and face absolutely no consequence, no pathos, nothing happens as a result of it beyond everyone decides, well, that about wraps it up for this movie, and then a whole bunch of dads have a great time rocking out together.
Oh, did anybody get the feeling? Like, did you see the costuming on John Goodman earlier in the film? He was wearing jeans with a vest over plaid.
Yeah, that first number, the way he's dressed is atrocious.
I'm convinced someone dressed in that way is revenge for, a misunderstanding on set. Like, the costume designer had it out for him because he was hitting on his wife or something and thought, oh, I'm going to make him look terrible then because he embarrassed me. It's just, it's so bad. And then he puts on the blue suit and it's fine. But yeah, it's something to see. All the fashions there. I read one review and someone pointed out they all look like members of Hall & Oates. That's kind of appropriate.
Well, the thing about this film is that, I mean, there's not much point in going scene by scene through the plot of this movie, because quite frankly, there's so little of it and none of it adds up to anything, as we've already acknowledged.
Well, so I mean, it does add up because you're also forgetting, in addition to the Russian mob, they piss off a bunch of neo-Nazis and they all get turned into mice.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Don't forget when the band gets turned into zombies so they can play Caribbean music that sounds no different than any of the other music in the film.
Oh, did it look like it was rotoscoped to you? Like the green hue over their faces? Well, it looked, struggled to keep up a few frames there.
It looked like early 90s like VFX on Saban Entertainment.
Well, here's the thing about it. I think rather than going through the plot of this movie, I think there are some certain ways we can look at it, starting with the fact that as an overall production, because we're already sort of hinting upon this, because the thing about the original Blues Brothers is when you watch it, it is a good-looking, gritty film full of life and energy, beautiful staging, beautiful camera work. Like, it's just a top drawer production. This film is shot in Toronto, doubling for Chicago. And it, trust me, you'll be able to tell that pretty quickly.
So it's the second city.
Yeah. And honest to God, I don't know what happened, but this is an ugly film from start to finish. David Harrington's photography on this movie is embarrassingly flat and ugly and garish in the worst possible way.
Well, it's like they gave a very toyetic lighting and color design to the film while having like the least toyetic narrative possible. Like, who's gonna buy action figures of Duck Dunn, you know?
Maybe, you know, I found my in. This is my moment. I'm going to read the plot of the Nintendo 64 game Blues Brothers 2000, the toyetic tie-in to the film.
I do remember that.
The player starts out as Elwood in prison, who needs to get the band back together for the Battle of the Bands. That's why he escapes prison in this continuity. It's in less than 2 days. He saves his guitarist, Cab. That's a little bit different from the film. He defeats the warden, and he progresses through Chicago in hopes of finding Mac and Buster. After going
So he already knows them before he's in prison?
That's right. After jumping across the rooftops, the player enters Willy's club, where Mac is being held captive. After he defeats
By
Willy,
whom?
Willy the drummer is a villain in this game.
What?
Okay. So, yes, so after defeating Willy, Mac says that Buster has ran away to the old graveyard. Arriving there, the player finds the evil tree has put Buster in a cage, and a final battle takes place in a swamp at the end. And that is the plot of Blues Brothers 2000 for Nintendo 64. A way tighter story idea than what we ended up
clocking
with.
Clocking in at a trim 86 minutes. They brought it in on time and under budget. All they needed was extra stunt doubles for the tree scene. It's just like, that at least is a story. This is like an assemblage of scenes and sequences that don't even seem to obey any kind of like internal consistency. And like that, I think that's the big problem in trying to read this film, because like it feels like trying to look inside the Joker's brain, where it's just constantly reforming itself as needed. Like, think about the way that music is presented in this film. That's not to say, like, at least from what I remember, the Blues Brothers V1, it's not like they had, like, crazy staging or, like, you know, the intricate dance numbers or anything that we've seen in, say, like, a Stanley Donen film. But they feel big, they feel special, there's a sense of, you know, vitality about it. Here, the first two numbers we get are diegetic performances of Dan Aykroyd singing a terrible song about the costs of separation, and John Goodman wearing the aforementioned terrible outfit, like, smacking his ass and singing about how he's looking for the fox. And we know from true stories he can sing fairly well. He's not doing that here. And then Aretha Franklin shows up, which normally is not a bad thing.
Oh, you know what? Are we just going to go through it, like, piece by piece?
Well, I'm saying this is the point-counterpoint, because the first two scenes set it up where, at least it's, like, plausibly diegetic, and then the third number just happens. Like, it's airdropped into the film.
Well, the problem isn't that, you know, I mean, the diegetic, non-diegetic thing, because the original film breaks the diegesis frequently throughout it. The problem here is that
there's an attempt to integrate it, whereas here, Aretha Franklin says respect, and then we just cut away, and then there's, like, full backing track, and we have a musical number.
Oh, you know, absolutely. And I mean, it's basically her just standing there singing while doing cutaways to barely choreographed dance numbers with Dan Aykroyd, John Goodman, and the kid playing Buster. And by barely choreographed, it's basically John Landis put a camera down in one spot and they're just tracking either to the left or a little to the right in this clearly fully built used car lot that they're just sort of shooting, or car lot they're shooting inside of. And again, like, it's so small, it's so tight, and it's constricted, and every single production number in this film is small.
They're dancing like dads at a family barbecue, like, when it starts getting dark and someone turns the music up a little.
Yeah, it's such an ugly scene. But you know what? To that scene's credit, that's my favorite scene up until the musical number, where they play, you know, the old hit, Respect. I did not mind us catching up with McIntyre Murphy and Blue Lou Marini. And yeah, I think it's so funny that after they ditched her the first time, they ended up back with her. Both of them. Like, they're just best buds who sometimes, you know, he sometimes just ditches his wife to go back to his fantasy band. And I think a whole movie could have followed those two characters with Aretha Franklin in a supporting role. Because
they come off as so likable.
It was so funny. And I just made a note here that says, is McIntyre Murphy a bad husband?
Yes!
Yes,
but
yes,
that's the thing. But that's the thing that gets me. In the original film, when he walks away, it's clearly that it's like, this is a terrible choice that he's making, but he's doing it. At least it's motivated. Again, in terms of the sheer laziness of this film, she walks in, basically warns him, don't do it, sings respect, and then as soon as she's done, where he's just basically sort of stood slouching there the entire time listening to her,
she basically tries his hardest to look sad, and he can't, and it's so charming.
But she basically turns, it's like, oh, if you're just going to be this mopey, might as well go with him. And it's like, why did this scene need to exist? This accomplished nothing. I mean, great.
It accomplished two things. We got to see that Aretha Franklin is alive and well and getting paid in 1998, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, and yes.
The second thing we learn is that Elwood, you ain't no good.
This film is like poetry. It rhymes. This is the George Lucas rule of cinema, where I did not mind any of this at all. And I like the idea that every 20 years, McIntyre Murphy just leaves and joins a band of some sort and then fails and then comes back.
Weirdly enough, 20 years after this movie, to the year, he did pass away. So there may be some credence to that theory. Why are you talking so much about death?
Well, so the next movie is Blues Brothers 3000 going to be Dan Aykroyd digging up the corpses of every dead Blues Brother? And dragging them behind the Bluesmobile?
Yeah, and then hologram Tupac's going to come out for the Battle of the Bands.
That's good.
Well, he already did work with Tupac back on Nothing But Trouble, so there we go.
And Belushi, Jim Belushi, also worked with Tupac.
Yeah. So, but yeah, this is the problem with this film, is that it just jumps from scene to scene, and none of it adds up to anything. I mean, you have, technically, the Russian mafia subplot with them chasing them around. You've got the...
They go on this cross-country rampage seeking to kill these men because they refuse to pay them shakedown money at a bar they burned down.
Yeah, and then beyond that, you know, you have, yes, it's not even really a subplot with the neo-Nazi survivalists, because they show up for one scene, disappear for the rest of the film, then show up in the climax of this movie again. So the only other real ongoing plot line that really matters is, Cable's attempts to capture them, to recover both his money, and because he's just so annoyed with Elwood and the frustration that he's caused him. Which does lead to, arguably, I think, if there is the second best scene in this film, in this movie, or at least some of the best stuff, is finally when Joe Morton catches up with them at the tent revival. Because ultimately, Elwood and the band, basically in a moment of despair where they've run out of gas, and basically only one of them realize, hey, why doesn't one of us go get gas? They decide to keep walking, come back to this tent revival, where, yes, James Brown is back at reprising his preacher character from the first film. And Cable shows up in the middle of this performance of John the Revelator that's far more energetic and energizing than the one that opens the film with it.
I'll tell you a bit, when I heard the first time, I thought they were saying John the Rebel Leader, and I'm like, what is this song supposed to be about?
Yeah, but this ultimately leads to a scene that is absolutely nonsensical, and yet, from this point forward, the film actually has a degree of energy to it, which is basically Joe Morton in basically a scene echoing Jake's revelation scene from the first film, is pretty much possessed by the power of God, I guess, in the sense.
Pretty much, he fulfills his destiny by being lifted off the ground and, like, entering the heavens. Which, it's weirdly similar to the Coen brothers' Ballad of Buster Scruggs, the Tim Blake Nelson sequence, which is yet another odd overlap between this film and a Buster.
Yes, but, basically, Cable is transformed into his Blues Brothers gear, comes down, and then proceeds to sing the hell out of the John the Revelator for the rest of the track. And
does anybody else think that that's the moment where he gets brain damage? Because later on, he just lets Elwood run off with a child while the police are circling them. And this is a man of the law.
This is how you know, though, that Elwood's earned his respect. Because it's the end of every, like, cop-criminal, are-they-friends movie, where they, like, look at each other and he's like, Well, the cops will be here any moment. Guess you better start running. Only it's two guys wearing dark suits and sunglasses over a kid that nobody wants to hang out with.
Well, but here's the thing. Yeah, so basically, from this point forward, yes, Cab, as he's now going by, joins them. And in probably one of the more amusing gags in the film, he is in the front seat of this car that's now crammed with every member, extended member of the band. And he is just ranting and raving away about the value of music and how this is how life should be. And everybody just looks super annoyed for the most part, while Joe Morton is just ripping through these lines and, you know, committing far more energy and time and effort to this project than it really deserves on his part.
Well, and to be fair, like, the rest of the cast around him, other than Buster, is like 75 years old.
Fair point. But yes, this leads to eventually this battle of the band. Well,
they meet their agent once they have the band together, and he books them for two shows. The first one, they think they're playing at a blues festival, but it's really a bluegrass festival. So they have to put on fake beards and sing Ghost Riders in the Sky, which causes a bunch of skeletal ghost riders to come out of the sky and electrocute a Russian mafioso trying to assassinate them. And then they get booked to audition to play in a battle of the bands hosted by, what's her name, Queen Musette?
Yes,
Erykah Badu, who, of everyone involved, deserves so much better.
Well, yeah, and from this point, yes, this leads to the scene we were partly describing earlier, which is basically the band arrives and she asks them to play something Caribbean, which leads to a baffling scene where Elwood starts listing off all the stuff they would play, but not Caribbean music, and she decides instead just to turn him, Mac, and Cab into zombies. Now, here's the thing. John Landis directed the music video for Thriller. Okay, folks?
Oh, that's a good point.
He made... This is what I don't understand, because it looks like they were painted green, like they were supposed to add an effect onto them afterwards, digitally, and then they just never did it? Like, I don't understand what... Like,
it's the Titan AE of musical numbers.
It's just like, I honestly don't understand how John, like, I can only imagine John Landis was on the set of this film and just does not care. Because so much of what goes on in this movie is so haphazard and perfunctory. Like, even, okay, one of the big things about the original Blues Brothers was that at the time it held the record for most cars crashed in a film. Yeah, and when
I
you
did come across that. That's an odd distinction, but an important one.
But when you see the sequence where it takes place, yeah, it's a, you know, orgy of mayhem on screen and is just giddy in terms of how much they're getting away with. When you get to the sequence which tops that one, quote unquote, in terms of how many cars they pile up by one, literally there is a point where after the initial crashes start happening, all they're doing is like launching a car into the air barely. Like, they're not even bothering to explain where the cars are coming from. What's happening is just car flips, adds to the pile. Car flips, adds to the pile. Car flips, adds to the pile. This goes on for, like, 3 minutes of screen time.
Yeah, it's long and never actually exciting. But, like, this is also the same film that, like, think about when they go to the funeral. Because they're trying to get, who is it, Mr. Fantastic? Mr. Fabulous. They're trying to get him back in the band. But normally that would require scripting or some clear sense of what they're doing. The film answers that question by having them drive into the graveyard and in an overhead shot, we then just hear John Goodman's voice go, well, I understand that he's a funeral director now, but do we really have to go to the graveyard to convince him to join the band?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, that's one way you could have done the scene, giving further credence to, like, there's no right way or universal, like, methodology to making a film I accept that. Different people have different approaches, but, like, every possible decision this film makes, makes, like, the categorically wrong one.
But this is what bugs the hell out of me about this movie, because I can understand Dan Aykroyd screwing up on to a degree. Aykroyd is one of those guys, as you noted earlier, Chris, who is a great idea man, but he needs somebody to discipline him when it comes to writing. The original Blues Brothers, as Landis has acknowledged, that was that basically Dan Aykroyd wrote about two phone booths worth, phone books worth of ideas.
So it's got to be good.
And then Landis had to go through and just, like, strip it down to the essentials and remove all the filler. Ivan Reitman acknowledges one of the reasons he encouraged Aykroyd to write with Harold Ramis on the original was because Aykroyd's original idea for Ghostbusters, as, again, you were noting, Chris, is so, was so gonzo and completely over the top in terms of all the fantasy elements to it that he needed to strip it back. And Aykroyd, apparently, again, on this film, had the same issue. For example, the scene where, in order to get around the police barricade, the Bluesmobile goes under the water and drives through it and comes out.
Yeah.
Aykroyd apparently wrote a scene where what would happen is they get underwater and then a propeller comes out from behind the Bluesmobile to propel it through the water in order to make logical sense as to how this car would move through this. Landis basically told him, it's a magic car, Dan. It's just going to do whatever the heck I told it. Neither answer in this instance is good, but at least you get a sense as to where Dan Aykroyd's headspace was.
But they also, this is a film that has a magic car that goes under the water, and it's still boring.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's still a terrible sequence. It's just the matter of, like, again, I don't understand. I just don't get how John Landis messed up this much. Because, like, again, I think Landis, at once upon a time,
was maybe that's why he didn't want to use the propeller.
Well.
Oh, this is... sorry, boys.
Oh, God, I just got that.
Yeah, of course.
Refer back to part one of this episode.
Isn't this so weird we're talking about Blues Brothers 2000? I just had a moment where my spirit was hovering over my body. And we're talking about a movie that no one talks about. And do you guys find any value in Blues Brothers 2000? Like, what did you bring to this movie? Like, we're saying so many things. We're making statements. But is there any value for someone wasting their 2 hours and watching this film? Like, what did you... like, where did this leave you by the end of it? Because I feel like I'm watching a funeral. I feel like it's a goofy movie and we're saying a lot of goofy things, but I feel like it's a film that just oozes sadness. And we say things like magic cars and propellers and kids and police chases, but, like, it's just such a, it's almost like the truest form of a train wreck in cinema, because you're watching your childhood burn on screen. You know, like, even... you're watching Dan Aykroyd, an icon, burn down his legend. And, like, he's giving you the middle finger and saying, I dare you to like me. Yeah. I'm the king of Psy Factor, and I hate people.
Well, again,
it's so weird. It's such a weird film.
I think it was AV Club, Nathan Felder, who... he had a review for this film, and he says that, like, the thing about Dan Aykroyd that we tend to forget is that he has had some undeniably huge hits. Specifically, Ghostbusters, and, you know, to a much lesser extent, he comes to the well many years after its sell-by date and makes Ghostbusters 2, which is, like, a crass and more cynical version of the first one. And, like, you know, dusting off the Coneheads. And, like, just that weird anachronism in, like, in his humor. Just, like, he seems to really love slapstick and the past and not really know how to work with that in the present. And, like, here, this film is just that continuation. He's making a tacky sequel to something beloved many years after it stopped being a good idea.
But this is the thing that throws me, because, okay, to open this up a little bit and do the exact inversion of how we usually do these episodes, where we start off with the broad context and eventually get into the film proper. the thing is that this is a sequel, as we've repeatedly acknowledged, well past its sell-by date. This is an 18-year late sequel. And the thing is, it's not the only one like this. There are many, many times we have seen films where there are long belated follow-ups to them. And I'm always fascinated to know to what degree why these films exist, because in some cases, like the best case scenarios, when we're talking about these things, we get films like Blade Runner 2049, a film that follows up years after the original one and somehow magically ends up not only being as great as the original film, but somehow avoids screwing up the legacy completely when it could very easily have done so. And it ends up being sort of the exception to the rule where, yeah, it's a critical and creative smash, bombed like nobody's business, which is exactly what happened to the original film when it was released in 82.
Nobody's business. That's precisely what they got. But like, yeah, I mean, the Blade Runner follow-up, and hopefully we get to talk about one of those two films on our show. It's just, it's fascinating to look at the films individually and look at them into relation with each other. And I think to Chris's point, is that possible with these films? Because it seems all of her attention is occupied by just the central question of why does Blues Brothers 2000 exist? Because even the naming sounds weird. It's not Blues Brothers with an eye towards the future or the new generation as much as, hey, let's give the past one last hurrah. But the past that we're celebrating is a very different thing from, like, the affectative memory that people have of the first one. Like, it feels very much like a theme park that you would take, like, some retirees to, because it would be a nice way to kick up your heels and relax with something familiar.
Well, to this point, I mean, let's look at because the thing is, there are weird gestures in this film towards the idea of the future, quote-unquote, of both, I guess, the Blues Brothers and the blues itself. Because in this film, okay, the most obvious example is Buster, who, again, is a terrible character who, from the sounds of Aykroyd and Landis, didn't want here in the first place. But the point of the matter being, he is there. And the idea is that, ostensibly, Elwood becomes kind of a father figure to him. And the film ends with them running from the police to some nebulous future, who knows what. So there is the idea that somehow this is, that the blues, as it were, is going to be passed down. But having said that, this is also a film which, in addition to featuring a bucket load of blues legends, because we haven't even mentioned B.B. King is in this movie, in actually a role in this film. We also have, as we've already acknowledged, Aretha Franklin. Beyond that, we have
Wilson Pickett, who sings Wilson a song Pickett. About phone sex.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, and you have that large super group featuring Billy Preston. You have Eric Clapton.
You got Isaac Hayes on backing vocals, so think about the talent on display.
Oh, and for some reason, Steve Winwood is part of this band, yeah. Which just blows my mind, where it's like, I get Clapton being there, but why are you here? I'm not complaining, I just want clarification. But then you have, like, these little odd scenes where, for example, in terms of the Wilson Pickett number, who is the young male performer?
The young kid who I thought was Taylor Hanson. And, like, his soul man face is the Vinegar Strokes. It's weird, because he's just all of a sudden in the middle of this song, which has been stuck in my head for a week and a half, so I'm just bitter. But, like, there were so many famous people in this movie where it's like, did none of them know? Did none of them look at the script? Were they all just been like, hey, just come and record this song? Because, like, everyone seems to be in a good mood and having fun. And I don't see how that's possible. Like, I don't know. I guess the other piece why I think, like, 2000 is so weird, and, like, millennial branding, everything was 2000 or extreme, right? But, like, Blues Brothers isn't something that really connotes any kind of, like, type modernization like that, but narratively, like, it feels very much like a safe, white, middle-class dad narrative, because it's never, we have to change, it's just the rest of the world needs to come around and appreciate that we got it going on. So like, you know, oh, well, Aykroyd, you get to just keep on being Elwood, and you get to keep on listening to the blues, and really the best that the younger generation could possibly do in the form of Buster and in the form of Cab, being like, no, you guys were right all along. We're going to do it like you do it.
It really does feel like hanging out in Dad's Rec Room, the movie. And just talking about like just how sanitized the whole thing is. The final scene with that supergroup, it looks like it's trying to be the Last Waltz, but a very boring version of it where nobody's really having fun, but and no everyone's so good at playing.
Either. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And, like, there's just no sense of stakes. And, like, by the time the Battle of the Bands is over, you're like, wait, is this the end of the film? Because they end up having, like, the song off. There's no catharsis. There's no, like, them reaching deep inside to, like, have that one performance. They just play good music, and then the other band plays good music, and you just are nod and be like, yep, they can really play that guitar. And then Paul Schaefer comes out and says, oh, the Florida Gator Boys win. And then they all just shake hands and be like, well, you guys want to rock? And then everybody rocks out.
Well, here's the thing. I think the scene that pretty much sums up everything you're talking about here and everything we are all collectively talking about here is, number one, the performer we were talking about earlier was Johnny Lang. That's the young kid from the 634-5789 number, which features both Eddie Floyd and Wilson Pickett as part of it. But there is
a scene... Wilson's jacket.
Yeah. But the thing about it here is that the scene that I think really sums up everything that's wrong about this movie in terms of this whole notion of the future of blues and the sort of dad rock mentality is where Elwood actually meets somebody who are a band that was quote unquote influenced by the music of the Blues Brothers.
Thank and this you. Is a, cause yeah, I this, do not understand the purpose of this scene either.
This scene is basically acknowledging who was the flippin' leading blues act of the mid 90s. Blues Traveler, the most white, absurd, we're going to play your local fairground blues act that you can imagine.
The hook is a killer song, but I mean, yeah, Blues Traveler, which overnight the sales of harmonica vests just went through the roof.
Isn't it funny how that scene ends too? Like, where you're right, like these are the blues players of the new generation, and they ditch him in a parking lot. He's like, oh, hey guys, watch my band. Where'd you go?
But after telling him just how much Elwood is an influence, how much it would mean, he's, sure, kid. And for no reason, literally no reason, he's just, well, we're not doing that. Later, losers. Whereas the rest of the film is about how the love of music connects us all. It binds present and past. It's the same way that Christopher Nolan sees love in the film Interstellar. You know, here music is the fifth dimension. And for what? For an obvious gag that isn't even funny? They're just like, oh, well, no. It would be really great if in this scene we also make Blues Traveler look like idiots.
Like an idiot. And it's funny, this was a real good part, like a good moment where we could have tied the whole narrative together.
Yeah.
And it's played off in what's kind of a pretty mean-spirited joke when you start talking about it here, what the whole purpose of this film is. It's almost uncharacteristically mean.
Exactly.
To just stitch them like that.
Well, yeah, this is like, oh, thanks for the praise, losers. Come back when you're famous. And no one holds a candle to Dan Aykroyd.
And then there should be like a scene right after where someone's in the car and just directly asks him, have you ever seen the next generation of blues? And he says, nope, never seen it.
But here's like, yeah, I seen him left and standing there holding his thumb out.
But the thing about it is you're right. It is an incredibly mean-spirited scene. At the same time, I can't help but feel... Imagine, I'm trying to think of, okay, imagine this. Imagine you had David Bowie, and you built a film around the notion of David Bowie
They did. It was called The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Let me finish here. David Bowie is going to pass along the baton as being the leading musical star and creative mind of his generation to the next generation. And
that
the person
happened in Labyrinth.
Okay, but the point of the matter is that you end up, let's just say this film existed, and the person that he's handing the baton off to is Chad Kroeger. Okay?
Yeah, but does it make sense to then have Bowie suddenly, like, yank the baton back and be like, nope, too slow, and then steal away in a car?
I felt like you were going to say, Dave, like, David Bowie looks at the next young glam rocker and says, you look like a friggin' weirdo, and then runs away. Totally goes against the whole spirit of what that artist
stands for. Or he sees the next generation of glam rock, and it's also Blues Traveler. But, I mean, the problem is, Dave, though, is there a marked difference in authenticity or musical quality between Blues Traveler and what they perform in the film versus Dan Aykroyd's performance of the blues in this film?
No, there isn't, and I agree with you there, but that's not the case. It's just, it feels like the whole notion of, if Blues Traveler is going to be what the future of this genre is, maybe it's time to let it die. Obviously, that's not to say that blues has to die because Blues Traveler exists. I am sure there are tons of legitimately great blues acts out there that are pushing
forward. So this is a film that's motivated by its own annihilation?
But in some ways, I almost wonder, because if this is supposed, like, I mean, the original Blues Brothers, again, to come back to it, was that, as Aykroyd and Landis have admitted, a large part of the reason they did that movie was to try and give a shot in the arm to these acts who were struggling a bit at this point in time because of the changing nature of musical taste, the changing nature of the industry, and figuring that, you know, they could help boost it. And apparently they did. I don't know to the degree to which we want to really just fully flat out credit those two for having done it, but I don't think it's...
And certainly by 1998, I don't think Dan Aykroyd is doing Eric Clapton a solid by having him appear in the close of this film.
No, absolutely, and that's the thing. It's like, I mean, Aykroyd isn't, you know, he isn't a hot rising star like he was when he made the first one. He's making a film that openly acknowledges the absences of, you know, key components of the original, and instead of making a film about acknowledging those differences, he just proceeds to ignore them. He then, you know, makes a film that's, you know, ostensibly about, you know, still the value of blues, but in 1998... Again, you know, it's not like B.B. King wasn't, you know, already doing pretty well for himself at that point in time. You know, it's like, I mean, part and parcel of the end of this movie is when we see that super group together, is that we acknowledge, yeah, it's a super group. This is a group of people who are already doing pretty okay. So it's not like that they're doing a shot in the arm to anybody in this case. So again, we circle back to the question of, what's the point of this movie?
But, I mean, like, the sense I get of Dan Aykroyd as a person watching this film, I think it's more like it ends on this note of, like, oh, the Florida Gator Band is so great, you know? But I almost get the sense not like, you know what, blues has moments, you know, they're still the best, but now it's time to move on to other things. I feel like Dan Aykroyd genuinely thinks at the end of this film, it's not like, okay, we never need to do another Blues Brothers. I think he probably sees it as, like, lighting the piano on fire and being like, ha, now follow that.
We're going to kill the Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
I thought there was going to be, like, a nice emotional climax where, like, maybe they'd say, oh, yeah, like, these old, you know, legends are overpaid and they have so much money and they're better than us, but we have heart and no one can take that away. Yeah, right? And then it's, no, they just win. And that's it. And then it kind
of
doesn't really
end.
Yeah.
It's like all that's missing is like this film to have a title card that says the end ... like it sets itself up as an open universe, but like it can't be. Like, what do you do after this film? Because like, oh, we went through all those hurdles, and it turns out people that are more famous than us are better at impressing a Battle of the Bands audience than we are.
I kind of question, like, so they had an audition for the Battle of the Bands, but they were under a spell, so I kind of think, you know,
and Erykah Badu
was
saying half of their song for them.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, I'm not sure why they're there to begin with. I feel like they were kind of, you know, grandfathered in because of the zombie clause.
Yeah, it's just nepotism.
So, yeah, I don't think they should have won in any reality because, you know, they should have been there to begin with. But that's
also a technical disqualification because they didn't play Caribbean music.
Yeah.
Well, but this is the frustrating thing. Well, here, I'll back it up, actually. Did anybody watch the mid-credit scene by any chance?
The mid-credits?
Towards
everybody else sings that song?
Nope, there is a scene, actually, after everybody sings, the credits roll, and there's a scene midway through where it's James Brown
returns,
and he starts singing, what is it, Please, Please, Please? Please, Please, Please. And John Goodman joins him, and it's him as his preacher character begging presumably a woman not to leave him. And, you know, there's John Goodman sort of comforting him and keeps glancing back to see how she's reacting. And I don't know where this is supposed to take place in terms of the context of this movie. Like, I don't know, like, did they go back to the revival tent? If so, why? You know, was this a deleted scene that they just tossed in midway through the film? I don't know. Which, again, just speaks to what a structural mess this whole godforsaken...
No, but it makes perfect sense when all this film is and ever was is getting a bunch of famous blues people you know to come have fun on camera.
And that's the unfortunate. It barely works as a concert film. Maybe if these were electrifying performances like the original, it'd be enough to keep you coming back. But right now, it's just a lackluster road trip movie with
the aesthetics of this film is a steam iron over everything. Everything just gets flattened to the same look and the same affectative response.
And it's very noticeable that basically from this point forward, Aykroyd's career as a leading man was effectively done at this point. I mean, I think we could honestly say it probably the mid-90s had already kind of killed it, but this was the final nail in the coffin for that.
Likewise, I think his performance in Crossroads is a bit of a dark horse.
But he was not the lead, so we're not going to hold that one entirely against him. But then Landis, who was so apparently fed up with the experience having made this film, that he has never made another studio film again and has pretty much worked on the independent circuit. Now, I honestly haven't seen the films he's made since then, such as Susan's Plan or Burke and Hare, although I do want to see Burke and Hare. But yeah, I think it's very noticeable that this is basically the film that buried their Hollywood careers to greater or lesser extents. I mean, Aykroyd hangs in there on that Ghostbusters franchise, you know, desperately wanting to continue it and make, you know, doesn't matter who he has to step upon in order to have that happen, he will do it.
Well, and I think it's nice that they're finally giving it back to the fans. But, like, last episode, you and I got into some debate over the idea of True Stories as a vanity project. It does not hold a candle to the amount that this film is a vanity project. Except it comes at a time when Dan Aykroyd has no rational sense of vanity to be riding upon.
You're not wrong.
There's just that sense of garishness about that, where it's like, Dan Aykroyd, why did you make this movie and why now? Like, if you made this in 1985 or 1988, like, I feel that would be more palatable, but it's like, it comes out as like, it's just such a sneering and purposeless movie that doesn't really do anything particularly well. And like, it's a refusal to change. It's a refusal to grow. This is Dan Aykroyd stamping his feet and being like, no, I'm still relevant because I made that thing you love. And famous people know me.
It's not over till I say it's over. I'm Dan Aykroyd. I think there's a really good Blues Brothers-esque movie to be made about the making of Blues Brothers 2000, because I think in the historical context of, like, you know, what we know about John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, their time on Saturday Night Live, the films they've made together, their live performances, you know, the live performances, when you take into account all of that as one complete story, there's still a lot of worth here in Blues Brothers 2000. The first time I saw this film, I was bored to tears and I just hated it. I can't even describe how I felt about it, but watching it this time, I kind of enjoyed it a little bit more. And I do think if you, as a fan of the Blues Brothers, there's a lot to enjoy here as a, like the Star Wars holiday special there, you know, it is a vanity project, but knowing the context of the kind of life Dan Aykroyd has had in the past, the stardom he achieved in the beginning and then, you know, lost in the following years, along with like being in the shadow of like true, you know, amazing greats, you know, rock and roll stars, also fellow cast members. You got Bill Murray, Carrie Fisher, you know, all these people. Dan Aykroyd is always the dark horse in that race.
And he's and the only one that ever seems to be left alive, at least by the time this film comes out.
Right.
But in those terms, like, wow, suddenly I feel bad for Dan Aykroyd.
And I think once you watch it through those lenses, it doesn't excuse this poor excuse for a movie, but it helps you watch Dan Aykroyd's performance with that added context. And there's just so much sadness on screen, even though he's doing his best to smile through it and be funny, there is a very sad... I really feel like Dan Aykroyd was... This was a film about grief, and this was his way of accessing that dark part of his soul that misses John Belushi, you know, the friend he hasn't had for years, because he really was... You know, a bandmate, a buddy. You know, they got into trouble together. They broke a few laws together, and this seems like his way of reconnecting with a dead friend. And I do believe, as a fan of both those individuals and you know their Saturday Night Live history, there's a lot here to enjoy. Is it good? It's not really good. But
there are funny bits. It's
absolutely. I
don't think
there
are any funny scenes.
There are no belly laughs, but you know, there are laugh lines. I really enjoyed when Dan Aykroyd took off like his sunglasses when he first meets Cab. You know, because the only time that I can recall that John Belushi takes his glasses off, it's a really nice moment. He reveals his eyes and his soul to his jilted lover. And then goes back to being John Belushi, and it's played for a laugh. And here, Dan Aykroyd could have done that, but instead he chooses to play a vampire.
Yeah.
He's at the sunlight when he takes off his hat and glasses.
That explains his horror at the sight of Jesus, too.
Yeah.
Well,
right. So,
well, I will say that. Oh, sorry.
No. I'm just saying, like, I still think you have to do a lot of homework. You have to read a lot of supplemental material, which not everyone is going to want to do, but I do think there's a really, maybe not rewarding, but there's an experience to be had here that can maybe be, a warning of how not to approach grief.
Well, because that's the thing though, Chris, and where I think I can agree with that to a surprisingly large extent. But at the same time, like, I feel like that any attempt, like, if we're solely looking at it through this film, I feel like any attempt to deal with grief, like, Aykroyd is in a sense of denial about it, where it's like, no, this film can be about feelings. It can be about, okay, no, I'm fine. Just hand waving away and being like, everything's fine. Everything's right. Normal. I just need to get up on stage and rock out with the boys. That's going to be great. Hey, everyone, I'm putting shaving cream on my head. Isn't that wacky?
Oh.
A grieving man wouldn't do this. And it's like, yeah. Dad hasn't moved out, but it's the weekend before and you know that things aren't good because he's trying really hard to just make you smile and make sure everything's okay.
So what you're saying is Blues Brothers 2000 is the divorced dad of films, and it just wants, it's trying so hard to, you know, let you have a good time, but really we're just happy to have your company, Dad. You can relax.
Well, yeah,
I love
it's like
you.
Dad, it's okay, stop pretending and just feel. We want you to miss your friend. We want you to acknowledge that time passes and we can't just retreat into the same 12-bar standards that people have been playing since, you know, the late 1800s. You know, maybe there is more to music than Bo Diddley. You know, I found that hard to believe at some time too, Dad. Let go. And it seems Aykroyd gets so close to doing that, and then he turned around and wrote a script of him doing the opposite.
And on that cheerful note, we should probably turn to hits and bits.
What else can we do with this film? We basically psychoanalyzed it, did a whole lot of projection, spent 20 minutes talking about John Landis's legal history. What a long and strange year of this podcast it has been.
This everything described here would have been a great HBO show. Mm-hmm. Like, there is a lot of value with the Blues Brothers franchise. I do recommend watching it as at least once, and then you can forget it exists because you're not going to play it in your car. You know, one of these.
I can play it in my car because I have a Nintendo 64 hooked up.
I mean, in the way, like, this is the Beach Boys Kokomo of films.
Oh, God.
Just, Brian Wilson's not there. Some of them are there, just not the talented ones. And it kind of sounds like it sometimes, but most of the time it does not.
I'm going to say that is probably the most damning statement about this movie that anybody has made so far tonight.
But as a completist, you need to have it in your record collection, and that's what this movie is.
I have seen the Mike Love Beach Boys live, and let me tell you, some of those songs sounded pretty close.
Well, we all know the best Beach Boy was John Stamos, so... So
now
yeah,
that's the man who understands the blues. So, David, Blues Brothers 2000, Hits and Pits, where we celebrate the little things that make us smile. David, since you're probably the most positive-minded out of all of us, why don't you go first? What's a hit that Blues Brothers 2000 offers?
One little gag I appreciated is there is a moment early on when... Elwood's meeting the mother, and they're talking about the fact that Jake is dead, and Elwood just makes the statement, well, at least he's in a better place. And then there is a hilarious cutaway to a statue of Jesus that looks like it's in that sort of, basically giving a face of, how do I break this to you gently? Just stand there. And it's just, it's a simple gag, but it's legitimately funny. Likewise, the moment when Cable looks up on his computer Jake's criminal history and the pop-up windows don't stop coming. Again, it's a super simple, cheap gag, but it is kind of legitimately funny. So I will give those shout-outs as a hit on this one. What about you, Chris? Is there anything that positive you can say towards this movie?
I really... I feel like viewing it as a séance is a positive thing. It's not fun to watch, but like you're helping a buddy. Like Dan Aykroyd is this like larger than life figure at this point in pop culture, but getting past that and looking at it as just a movie that has flaws and is in reality not very good. I really did enjoy the Matt Guitar Murphy scene with Aretha. I thought that was where they most closely adhered to the original tone, even though it was in a very sterile looking car lot. I just thought, yeah, I can totally believe they would have another mundane day job after that. And that seems like, you know, the natural progression for these characters. I just feel like if they nailed that tone a little bit more, I feel like if this movie was just a little bit more laid back and didn't worry so hard about looking cool at the party, I think it might have been okay. But obviously that didn't happen, and we'll never know.
Yeah. What about you, Andrew? What have you got?
Let's see. I think Joe Morton is the standout here. I mean, his performances are at least exciting, and he sings pretty well, and he's reasonably funny. Out of the whole, like, actual cast, he's probably the best one. I was surprised because even though it's apparent how little the band themselves can act, they do produce a good number of funny moments. I give special shout out to the fact that Steve Cropper and Donald Dunn host a radio show, and you think like it's going to be like Zoo Crew morning radio hour, and they're like, "Hi, you're listening to Cropper and Dunn. Today we talk about mandatory life sentences for third-time felons." And I did like that.
That's a good catch. And I think
the woodenness of the musicians' performances gives it a discreet kind of charm. And again, it's like that sort of relaxedness where, like, they're not professional actors or comedians, but there is that sense of earnestness, like, well, I thought it was pretty funny. And, like, it's hard to be mad at that. Like, those scenes are disarming in ways that Aykroyd really phoning it in isn't. I don't know why, I think it's just the stiltedness of that line, but I did laugh at the end when Daryl Hammond, who I've always been of two minds about, when he watches the mobsters get turned into mice, and then he just turns and angrily points at Queen Musette and says, "Now don't you try that boo-joo crap on me," and then she turns him into a mouse.
You know what? One thing I want to add to, I really enjoyed Daryl Hammond's reaction when that boat filled with explosives landed on him, because it looked like he didn't realize he was filming a take, so he barely acknowledges it, and it looks like he's winking at someone else off camera. I thought that was kind of funny, because maybe it was just a, you know, outside of the box kind of decision. I appreciated it. I also thought, you know what? I wouldn't have minded more Daryl Hammond in this movie. And like you guys, I forgot he was in it, you know, later on.
He probably has forgotten he was in it, too.
That's true.
No, Daryl Hammond, he's one of the, he's like Tim Meadows, where it's like they weren't universally funny or hilarious, but every now and then they could bring the ruckus. I don't know if I would say that Daryl Hammond really does that here, because he is basically playing like, Not necessarily like neo-Nazi as much as like sovereign citizen. And this is, what is it, 5 years after Oklahoma City? It feels a bit too on the nose, or at least not the kind of thing that you'd milk for laughs in what's nominally a family-friendly throwback sequel.
Yeah.
Well, but what do I know? I've never made a single hit. Is there anything else we want to celebrate? Erykah Badu is fun. You know, she is someone that has a deep and very interesting, like, holistic sense of herself as an artist in multiple media. Obviously, like, this is probably one of the lowlights of her resume, but, like, there's a sense of presence she has on screen where it's like, the material is so far beneath you, but you're elevating it by being in it.
I want to say this before we forget. I think I like the Ghost Riders in the Sky scene, you know, where they kind of do a riff on the old the country bar scene from the original. Yeah. And I would love to be there during the writing sessions where they're like, remember how funny it was when John Belushi had a whip and he was whipping cigarettes out of people's mouths? Instead, this is going to be a big special effects extravaganza. I just like, I want to see that leap where someone thought that would be a better choice. And it's so goofy and dorky. I kind of don't mind it, although it's obviously added in there to appeal to children. 10 stars.
Out of 100.
Out of 100.
Yeah. David, is there anything else you want to celebrate about Blues Brothers 2000?
A small one. I'm at least going to give credit, not necessarily to John Goodman's performance, because it's not that he's bad. He just has nothing to do in this movie. But I am at least going to say I appreciate the fact that they did not try and make him like a Jake stand-in, a Belushi stand-in here.
Yeah, learning from the mistakes of the producers, which wouldn't be made for another 15 years.
Yeah, it really is just, you know, he comes in and he's playing a very sort of mild and meek character. I also admit that when you basically have the sequence of Elwood going through the entire history of the Soviet KGB, basically.
That was very Dan Aykroyd. That was a very Aykroyd-esque scene there.
Yeah, yeah, because it goes on about 30 seconds longer than it should.
Yeah, and it's, but it's just one of those things where it's like, okay, that's, I admit that's funny, and nobody can quite rapid fire that kind of dialogue quite like him. He's still got that going for him, but yeah, the rest of this movie, not so much. But yeah, I guess
so. For Pitts, then, I guess we've certainly said a lot. Is there any particular aggravating elements of this film that we haven't addressed in the discussion proper, if you can call it that?
I've got one. I've got one.
Okay.
During that scene where, you know, Elwood meets with Cab at the police station, you know, they talk about his prior arrests and show his criminal record on the screen. And there's a gag where you see all of the prior arrests popping up and there's like, you know, a bunch of pop-ups. And it really bothered me when he looks up Jake. There's no picture of Jake. There's no headshot. I felt like this is the one moment here where you can have a cameo of some sort. You even used a publicity photo of Cab Calloway, but you couldn't pay money to the Belushi estate and just use any picture of him. It drove me crazy.
Or you get Buster to bump into Jim Belushi and steal his wallet.
Anything, any kind of Belushi blood would have been welcome in this film. And it just, I don't, it must have been a likeness rights issue, I imagine, because, again, they have that really obvious publicity photo of Cab Calloway. I think it's from the back of the VHS, and that's the photo Elwood carries around with him everywhere. But, like, it's a small nitpick, but it drove me nuts.
Yeah, I honestly don't know what that is. Like, I don't know. I mean, again, particularly, it is a Universal film. Universal released the original one. You would think, if nothing else, they could have at least used a shot from the original film in this one in some capacity. So I honestly don't know what on earth was going on there, unless there was something about the Belushi estate, or at least whoever controls John's side of the estate. I guess, again, Jim Belushi wanted to be in this film. It was just for scheduling purposes he couldn't. So presumably he would have been fine with Brother John having his shot in there somewhere. So who knows?
Right.
Is that the same way that apparently afterwards Dan Aykroyd like invited Joe Morton to join the Blues Brothers like traveling band as a performer, and scheduling issues prevented Morton from doing that?
No, that would suggest that there's actually some level of dignity that Jim Belushi has, and I think his career has repeatedly proven that that is not the case.
Don't they perform as the, I'm almost positive they performed as the Blues Brothers
post
film, and they also have a separate band called the Have Love Well Travel Band. I own the album, that's how I know that. and it's signed. Anyways. I just accessed that part of my brain. So I want to know the Belushi side of things, because I understand scheduling conflicts, but I also understand how, you know, some actors will go out of their way and fly across the continent to film 2 minutes of footage. Like Michael J. Fox filmed Family Ties during the day and Back to the Future at night. I don't believe for a second Jim Belushi wasn't available to film 5 minutes of footage.
Yeah, but you want to make it happen, you make it happen.
Exactly. The thing with that assumes, again, that Jim Belushi really has the care or drive to do anything. And honestly, look at the man's career. What has he actually done? What is anything that anybody is going to remember Jim Belushi for having done, aside from his 5 minutes of screen time in Michael Mann's Thief, the most tolerable he has ever been in anything.
What about the K-9 saga?
Oh, God.
We're begging for a gritty reboot. and then finally a team-up film with Tequila and Benetti.
There we go, folks. We got it in this episode. So, Jim Belushi, Just don't do anything, please. Just stay away. But on that mean-spirited note, I guess for another pit here, I really... Paul Schaefer.
Oh, yeah.
God.
The King of Thunder
Bay. So bad here.
Here's the thing. I feel bad because I was actually born in the same hospital that Paul Schaefer was.
Really?
Wait, you were born in Thunder Bay too?
Yeah, I was born in Thunder Bay.
Born in Thunder Bay.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Is this true? Both of you were born in Thunder Bay? In the birth home of Paul Schaefer?
Like I said, my family lived in Chappaqua, up near Thunder Bay, and right. Thunder Bay was the closest hospital around. So yeah, I was born in Thunder Bay.
Okay, so if nothing else, Blues Brothers 2000 has helped me and David realize that we were, in all likelihood, born in the same hospital, and that was the same hospital
as Paul Schaefer, the Clown Prince of Canada.
Yeah, and coincidentally, this happens over us talking about how much we hate Paul Schaefer in this movie.
Well, in Thunder Bay, I know this because my partner, she's from Thunder Bay as well. Okay. I feel like we should make a whole Thunder Bay Paul Schaefer podcast now. Yeah. Paul Schaefer has a street named after him. And also,
can we call it a podcast?
I think it's Schaefer Avenue. Also, this film was the moment in time where Paul Schaefer shaved his head completely bald and decided to keep that look going forward on the David Letterman show.
Well, I guess he got, yeah, the look does work for him. I will give him that. But here's the thing. Like, on one hand, it's really great to see Paul Schaefer, who was actually the original keyboardist for the Blues Brothers band, be in a Blues Brothers movie. He wasn't in the right. original one because effectively, and again,
issues.
Well, actually, sort of. Basically, Paul Schaefer had a choice. He could work on the Blues Brothers film, or he could work on Gilda Radner Live. And he had already committed to Gilda Radner Live. And this is apparently where the whole notion of Dan Aykroyd and Jim Belushi being sort of the bully boys of SNL worked in, because they apparently did not take his having committed to Gilda's show terribly well. Again, if apocryphal legend is to be believed. So on one hand, it's nice to see him show up and finally, you know, play with the band itself. On the other hand, his character is so flippin' annoying in this movie.
Like, it's next level obnoxious. It's the worst.
Yeah, it is like this phony French flamboyant, you know.
Yeah, he's like the majordomo for Queen Musette. But it's a role that confuses being obnoxious and loud with being funny. Like the shaving cream gag. Like, it's like, it seems to presuppose that the more you can drag something out and just, like, the louder people can shriek and flail, the funnier something becomes.
Yeah, it's just, it's so, so bad. And honestly, again, a very good indicator is that Paul Schaefer isn't really an actor. And, I mean, it's saying something when you are worse than Eric Clapton and Steve Winwood, who couldn't say dialogue to save their lives in this movie. They get one line apiece, and they're both awful here. So.
Okay, my producer has just passed on some information to me. The street in Thunder Bay is called Paul Schaefer Drive. Paul Schaefer Drive.
Oh, okay. I thought that was with an S, because that would be a fully contained statement. Paul Schaefer drives in Thunder Bay. Birthplace of Andrew and Dave.
There we go. Wow. What about you, Andrew? What do you have for a pit, if anything, here?
I think we've about covered it, but like, as someone who hasn't seen Blues Brothers in a very long time, there are some beats where I'm like, I feel like that has to be a callback to the first film, but it's like without understanding that reference, like, that is the extent of the joke. Specifically, I'm thinking when they're doing donuts outside the restaurant, and then, like, the old cowboy man shows up from out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And then walks back in, he's like, haven't I seen you boys before? And then the band starts eating quickly.
Yeah, he's Bob's Country Bunker. He's the owner of the country club they play Rawhide at.
Okay.
In the original film. And yeah, what kills me about that scene, it's like, okay, it's an unnecessary cameo and callback that we really don't need. What really kills it is that it ends on the oldest, lamest gag you can have. Check, please.
Check, please. Yeah. That's why I loved it. But yeah, like, The problem is, though, it's not that a film makes a reference that I don't understand. I haven't seen everything. And, like, usually jokes can also work independently of that reference. It's a bigger problem because when you have the studio trying to say, let's make this movie for kids, and they're saying, oh, we're going to have this great laugh line. It's going to be a callback to a brief moment in a film that came out 18 years ago. Like, it further just speaks to the problem that this is a film very much about the past and very much about old man music, while at the same time, the kid-friendly elements of it are baffling. Because I'm like, what 12 to 16-year-old would go see this movie and be like, oh, this film has everything I love about my childhood. Buddy Guy and underwater cars.
Well, more to the point, if you're a parent who's taking your kid to go see this because it's quote-unquote a family comedy, by the time you get to the strip club scene, you might be having second thoughts about the notion of, is this really for kids? And you wouldn't be wrong for having those thoughts. I don't understand, like, again, it's like this half-hearted thing where it's like, okay, fine, we'll make it for kids, but only half-heartedly, and we're still going to throw enough adult content in there that it feels really awkward, such as, yeah, the phone sex number with Wilson Pickett. Like,
yeah, because, like, kids aren't, they're either not going to pick up on that or they're not going to see why it's funny, you know? Not even in the sense, like, oh, it's inappropriate or whatever, but, like, most kids, I don't feel like they would have any reaction to that. The same way that to a 10-year-old that knows nothing of the blues, they are not going to feel any satisfaction watching Wilson Pickett sing, because the only important thing about that sequence is that we, as the audience in 1998, get to sit down and see Wilson Pickett sing.
Do you think there's at least one kid who cites this as the beginning of their love for the blues?
J. Evan Bonafont.
Well, we say that, but don't forget, or somewhere out there, Blues Traveler 2.0 is out there threatening to happen, so...
Blues Traveler isn't that bad, okay? They're certainly no worse than anybody else in this movie. I like to think of them as the thinking man's blues hammer.
You know what? I will point this out. I looked up trivia about Blues Traveler, and the name of the band is a reference to...
Blues Brothers 2000.
Sorry, Dave, I'm going to get this Ghostbuster reference wrong. Is it Gozer the Traveler?
Yeah.
Gozer, it's a Ghostbusters reference. Yeah. So there is that Aykroyd connection there.
Wait, oh, wow. Okay, wow. This is just insane.
That's just
And that's
sad.
Why he ditched him at the gas station after his performance.
Oh, ooh, boy. Oh, that's going to come back to haunt him. Bub-a-da-bub-a-da-bub. Ghostbusters. This has been a very weird conversation. And Dave, does this make our 52nd episode officially?
Yeah, this will be the 52nd regular episode, not including the bonus episode. So, yeah, well, we've done a year of the show, and this is what we arrived at.
Well, we end up with a long, meandering conversation where we discover that everything is fundamentally interconnected after all. And, I mean, considering we're a podcast about following those connections, I can't think of a more fitting way to conclude our first proper anniversary episode.
Yay. You know what? You guys are probably the only podcast that talks about Blues Brothers 2000. I'm not going to check, but I assume this is going to be the compendium of Blues Brothers 2000 information, and maybe one day it's going to make its way into a textbook. Who knows? I feel like if you want information about the film, there's only two spots, the trivia and on the Wikipedia page and here. So you know, there's always that.
Yeah.
Until, congratulations, guys.
Until Pitchfork drops the oral history of Blues Brothers 2000.
See, my real concern is going to be that we're going to, in a few weeks' time, when this episode actually goes up online, is we're going to put it up there, and then for some godforsaken reason, I'm going to have to put up with Max Landis having found us and then yelling at us for some godforsaken reason.
I think we got plenty we can yell at him about.
Oh, we'll, we do. But...
Look, if Max Landis wants to pick a fight, you know, he better know who he's fighting with. And if you want to learn more about us and pick fights with us, where can people find you on social media, Dave?
Well, you can find me at 24panels. Max, I'm just going to ban you, so you might as well just leave me be. Andrew, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at FilmsTripper. And Chris, where can people find you, you funny, funny man?
Oh, thank you. You can also find me on Twitter at Twofer Martin. That's number 2FER Martin.
Yeah.
And you can also find us in the same spot at the same time next week in whatever podcasting service as you join us in our very next episode. Now, David, I realize I forgot that Blues Brothers 2000 was my pick, so I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but can you think of where you would like to go after this record-setting car pile-up of a movie?
We need to get back to something good, folks. We also need to get away from music for after three episodes in a row of basically musicals or music-esque films. So instead,
yeah, it turns out you can stop the music after a while.
Yeah, but in this instance, I think we're going to turn our attention to a blind spot for me. One of the Coen brothers' more significant works, Barton Fink, starring John Turturro and following John Goodman there, which, yes, makes John Goodman the second individual who we've now followed for three episodes in a row. Congratulations, John Goodman. You've achieved the Raul Julia distinction on this program.
Yeah, because Louis Jordan did, but he did it through the back door. So I think he gets like a Raul with distinction award or something.
Yeah, and Orson Welles sort of as well. So,
did you guys ever read that mystery book, The Raul Julia Distinction?
No, but I hear great things.
It's really good.
Yeah. Well, on that note, Andrew, do you have any parting words for our listeners this episode?
Yes, please forgive us for what we've done. No, I do have words, David, and they're the same words that I always say. Remember, everyone, from the last year and into the next, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Especially if John Landis is running the set.
I'm so glad I'm not the only monster.